government says the weed-killing herbicide glyphosate, which is known by its trade name Roundup, is safe. And in fact, recently increased the amount of glyphosate it allows in food crops. However, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is an arm of the World Health Organization, says glyphosate is, and I quote, probably carcinogenic to humans. Government says safe. World Health Organization says dangerous. Today we pause to ask, which should we believe? The government or the World Health Organization?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned to the 1,012th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among over there in Sidovecchia who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Happy to be here.
Folks, it's like a miracle. Instead of spending our hot summer days in the field hoeing down weeds, as I once did, we plant crops genetically engineered to withstand the herbicide glyphosate. Then we sit back in air-conditioned comfort and let glyphosate kill all the weeds. Throughout the world, an area roughly equivalent to the landmass of the United States has been planted with crops genetically modified to withstand glyphosate, to which is applied hundreds of millions of pounds of glyphosate. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a subsidiary of the federal government of the United States, says glyphosate is safe for agricultural use and has recently doubled the amount it allows to be found in certain food crops. However, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is a subsidiary of the World Health Organization, recently announced that it ranked glyphosate 2A, which is, and I quote, probably carcinogenic to humans, unquote. Now, 2A is one rank above 2B, which is, and I quote again, possibly carcinogenic to humans, unquote. And it is one rank below 1, which is carcinogenic to humans. Wow. Being consumers of the food grown with glyphosate, we pause to ask, which should we believe? The government or the World Health Organization? Well, folks, here to help us look for an answer today, we have two people in the know. We'll start with Carolyn Cox, who is the research director for the Center for Environmental Health. Carolyn, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So happy to have you aboard. Carolyn, quickly, what exactly is a Center for Environmental Health?
We're a nonprofit organization. Been around since 1996. Our goal is to protect people from toxic chemicals. We have offices in Oakland, California, and New York.
Good. And who pays the way?
Like most nonprofit organizations, we're supported by donations from our supporters, grants from foundations, and we also have some revenue from litigation that we do.
Ah, how does that work? Just out of curiosity. You sue somebody and make them pay you some money, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. All right. Fair enough. Also, and what do you do as research director, Carolyn?
So my job is to make sure that the work that we do is scientifically accurate and, based in real data. We do a lot of testing of consumer products for a variety of different toxic chemicals, and I kind of manage that testing.
Oh, okay. Do we ever find glyphosate in human food?
It's not something that we've actually tested, but the answer, so I can't speak from direct personal experience,
okay.
But the answer is yes, glyphosate is like most pesticides, there can be what they call residues of those pesticides left in food, and glyphosate is not different.
Okay, fair enough. Also with us today, we have Rebecca Riley, who is Senior Attorney, Natural Resources Defense Council. Rebecca, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're the, first of all, what is a Natural Resources Defense Council?
So we are also a nonprofit organization. We've been around since the 1970s, and we work on many, many different aspects of the environment. So we fight for clean air, clean water, health issues, food issues, and my area, which is wildlife.
Wildlife, good. And who paves the way for the Natural Resources Defense Council?
So we also get money from our members and donors, and also foundations often give us grants to work on specific work.
Good go. And you are a senior attorney. Now, what does a senior attorney do for the Natural Resources Defense Council?
So I litigate cases, and I also lobby to get bills passed or stop bad bills. And then I do more general advocacy work like this, where you're, you know, trying to get a message out about a particular species and what's happening to it and how we can help.
Mm-hmm. And you have a campaign going at the Natural Resources Defense Council with respect to a species of wildlife, and that is?
The monarch butterfly, which is actually a species that we all probably remember from our childhoods being something we saw all the time. But now its population has crashed. It's declined by about 90% over the last 15 years. And it turns out that one of the main culprits is glyphosate, the same pesticide that the World Health Organization just deemed a probable human carcinogen.
Okay, so you're in there scrapping for the monarch butterfly. Do you ever think that when you were growing up that you would become a warrior for the monarch butterfly?
You know, I didn't, but I tell this story a lot. Something we did in our classrooms every year was the teachers would bring in monarch caterpillars, and we would watch as they built the cocoon and ultimately emerged as a butterfly. And it's one of those things that I really remember connecting me to nature. And to know that kids may not have that opportunity sometime in the future is a really sad thing.
So you can blame it all on a teacher in your past.
That's right.
Good for you. Well, not with us today, ladies and gentlemen, are representatives from the Monsanto Corporation nor the National Corn Growers Association. Whenever I do a show of this nature, I have always emailed in a request into the Monsanto Corporation because they're kind of like the kingpin of these sorts of issues, and I asked them to join us on the radio, and they never do. So it was no surprise this time when they turned me down, as they always do. But then I got an email back from the radio person or the media person at Monsanto, and she said, "The reason I turned you down is because you didn't give me enough time." So I responded and I said, "You can have any Saturday you want from here till the year 2050. So show up and talk to us. Maybe they will. That would be certainly interesting in my way of thinking about things." When I was a kid growing up in Montana, I worked for a lot of farms in the Yellowstone River Valley of Montana hoeing weeds and learned the value of a sharp hoe. And yet it was not a job I particularly enjoyed. And as a matter of fact, I used to watch the airplanes fly over and reach up and say, "Please come and take me away." And one finally did. Much has changed since then. If a couple of years ago, I did a radio show from the Phil and Barbara Hamburger Farm in North Dakota. Maybe it was South Dakota. But at any rate, this couple is farming 12,500 acres of different kinds of crops. And you could not do that if you had to weed those, you know, cull those weeds by hand. You have to have some kind of magic. And that magic, of course, is glyphosate weed killer. And it really has changed the nature of agriculture. So agriculture, of course, loves this technology. But the consumer is left wondering, is this safe for us to eat? And so that's what we're looking at today. So I'm going to start off with this question. You know, the great promise of glyphosate and GMOs was that it was going to reduce the amount of pesticides that we need to grow the food we need to survive. So when we come back from this quick break, I'm going to put that question to Rebecca Riley, and also we're going to ask Caroline Cox what they think. Has the promise been fulfilled? Do we now use less pesticides than before? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we're asking a question about glyphosate, which is it safe for us to eat? It's used in the production of so much of our food, and we wonder. So we're asking Carolyn Cox from the Center for Environmental Health, Rebecca Riley from Natural Resources Defense Council, and you. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, so much of our food is now grown in an environment saturated with the weed killer glyphosate, which is some know, as, of course, is Roundup. The federal government says that glyphosate is safe to use and has even doubled the amount it allows to be found in certain food crops. The center or the World Health Organization says, no, not so certain, and has ranked it as a probable cause of cancer. And so we're scratching our head. My goodness, who do we believe? Do we believe the federal government, which says glyphosate is safe? Do we believe the World Health Organization, which says it probably causes cancer? Who knows who to believe? And that's what we're working on today with Carolyn Cox from the Center for Environmental Health and also Rebecca Riley from Natural Resources Defense Council. Great promise of GMOs was that they would reduce the amount of pesticides in the environment. True or false? Carolyn, let's start with you.
I think the independent scientists who have looked at the data on pesticide use have concluded that here in the U.S., that's not true. Pesticide use has continued to go up with the use of GMO crops. And let me just give an example. Prior to GMO crops, the dominant herbicide used to grow corn was an herbicide called atrazine, and it had a variety of problems connected with its use. And so one of the arguments for GMO crops was we can switch away from atrazine. Well, if you look at the data, what's happened in the few decades since GMO corn became really popular, atrazine use has pretty much continued steady. It hasn't really declined much at all. And glyphosate use has exponentially increased. So really, there's no decrease there. In fact, there's an increase.
Well, not only did it increase, but it I have a graph here that from 1997, we used 1,000 tons of glyphosate, and now we're using 100,000 tons of glyphosate. So that's pretty good exponential, I guess. That's right through the stratosphere. Rebecca, do you see the same thing? What happened to the promise?
Well, you know, Roundup Ready crops, which are what we're talking about when we're talking about GMO crops and glyphosate, are designed to allow farmers to apply Roundup not just before they before the plants come up, but actually after the corn and soybean grows. That's the whole purpose. And so by design, we're actually spraying more and we're spraying later, and that's had real consequences. You know, glyphosate has actually been around since the 70s. And when it comes to the monarch butterfly, it wasn't having an impact when it was used at those lower levels before the emergence of GMO crops. But once we got GMO crops and we started spraying so much more heavily, we wiped out milkweed, which is the sole, pretty much sole food source for the monarch caterpillar, and the population crashed by 90%. So this is an example of a GMO crop with a very specific purpose that definitely results in more pesticide use, particularly when you're talking about Roundup, because that's the design.
Yeah, from 1,000 tons of glyphosate to 100,000 tons of glyphosate. The chart I'm looking at is kind of like a roller coaster. You know, you go all the way up and way up on top. It's incredible the amount we're using now. And how is this work panning out in the fields? Is glyphosate holding down the weed population, or is something else happening, Carolyn?
So what we've seen, because there's been so much glyphosate used, is the development of weeds that can tolerate glyphosate, or glyphosate-resistant weeds is another way that people refer to them. And it's such a problem that there's new varieties of GMO crops that have been engineered to be able to withstand not only glyphosate, but a second herbicide, so that farmers can use both these herbicides and kill off the weeds that can now tolerate Roundup glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing, again, is a further dependence on pesticide use caused by the widespread use of Roundup Ready crops.
Well, Rebecca, and of course what we're talking about is stacking of genetic traits in one or more of different kinds of crops. So, for example, one stack can be a resistance to glyphosate. Another stack can be a resistance to dicamba, which is 2,4-D, a constituent of Agent Orange. Another stack can be Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacterial pesticide. So you can have a single crop that has all of these things stacked within them. And Rebecca, you say that essentially glyphosate was what laid waste to the population of milkweeds, which was the food source for the monarch butterfly. But has there been any indication that the direct application of glyphosate and dicamba and everything else that we're using has had an impact on the organisms in wildlife? I mean, just spraying directly on top of a monarch butterfly, does that have any impact on the wildlife?
Most of our evidence is, you know, about these chemicals is their impacts on weeds, because that's what they're designed as. They're designed to kill weeds rather than wildlife or people. Mm-hmm. And so really what we know about them is that they're causing major problems for monarchs because they're killing those weeds. But we're also concerned with these combination products, and in fact have filed a lawsuit about a product called Enlist Duo that combines glyphosate and 2,4-D because of these superweeds, so that farmers can use one product to apply two pesticides at the same time. And we think this is a huge problem. Number one, because it's yet another source of glyphosate, which will be out there killing weeds. And number two, we're just adding another pesticide, which we know has real human health risks, 2,4-D, to the cocktail. And there's a question you start to wonder, when will it end? You know, when the weeds become resistant to both of those, will we just pile a third chemical on the top? And is that really the answer?
Mm-hmm. But as far as you know, that it's okay to spray monarch butterflies with glyphosate and they won't be harmed.
I wouldn't recommend it, but I'm not aware of any studies on direct effects on monarchs.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. Then, so the impact of all of this use of glyphosate means that we need to keep using even more glyphosate because the weeds develop the resistance. And not only do we need to use more glyphosate, then we also need to use more of other things like dicamba or 2,4-D. And so what happened to that great promise of genetically modified organisms that we would use less? Rebecca?
Well, like I said, these crops are designed so that we can use more pesticides. So, you know, by their design, they're to allow farmers to apply the herbicides without them killing the crop. And so, you know, it was never going to turn out that if we planted a crop that was resistant to a pesticide, that would lead us to use less of that particular pesticide.
So there was never going to be anyway. Carolyn, so did you ever believe the promise?
I've been studying the hazards of pesticides for the last two or three decades. And so I know enough about their problems. And so I never believed it. The promise. I think it's really important to look at.
Can you hold that important until we get back from the break?
Yeah.
We're going to have to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Carolyn Cox, Research Director, Center for Environmental Health, Rebecca Riley, Senior Attorney, Natural Resources Defense Council, and you, 800-624-2665 and 831-479-1080. Right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about who should we listen to and believe. The amount of glyphosate we use to grow our crops is really blown up. Way back in 1997, we used about 1,000 tons of glyphosate around the world. Now we're using 100,000 tons of glyphosate around the world. Wondering if this stuff is safe. And we're wondering with a couple folks who probably know more about these kinds of things than most of us. One is Carolyn Cox, the research director for the Center for Environmental Health, and Rebecca Riley, who's a senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Not with us today, representatives from Monsanto and the National Corn Growers Association, both of which declined to participate. Carolyn, you had a point that you wanted to make before we moved on to the next segment. Go ahead.
I always like to look at pesticides in general and something like glyphosate in particular and ask the question, do these really solve pest problems? And the answer is that they can be very good at killing pests. You put glyphosate on a weed, that weed will die. But what they don't do is solve the pest problem in the long term. And what we really need to look at is long-term sustainable management solutions that actually solve our pest problems. And I think there are farmers all across the country that are successfully, efficiently, effectively growing our food without using those chemicals. And they can provide a model for how the rest of agriculture should be shifting.
Mm-hmm. But I'll bet there are a lot of farmers out there in the United States of America who who really like the idea of killing all the weeds from the air-conditioned comfort of their tractor cab and don't want to get out there and hoe a weed. So there are probably a lot of people in both camps, but I want to address the issue of this disparity of thought. You know, the federal government the Environmental Protection Agency on behalf of the federal government says that the use of glyphosate is okay. Go right ahead and use it. As a matter of fact, you can use twice as much as you used before because we're doubling the amount we approve to be found in food crops. So the federal government is very happy with the use of this stuff. On the other hand, the World Health Organization has just ranked it a probable cause of cancer in human beings. It's probably a cause of cancer in human beings. Now, gosh, how do we go about looking at these two incredibly different ways of seeing the use of glyphosate? So let's start with the federal government and how it came to its conclusion. Does anybody have any idea? Rebecca, let's start with you.
The federal government is actually in the process of re-reviewing glyphosate, and they're actually due to put out a new finding at the end of July. And they've told us that they are taking a close look at the World Health Organization's recent findings on the health impacts. And they've also agreed, in response to a lawsuit filed by us, to look at the broader environmental impacts, including the impacts on the monarch butterfly. So that assessment is due to come out on July 31st. It will be a preliminary assessment, so the public will be able to comment on it. So when we see what they decide, hopefully they'll take into account some of the more recent evidence on both the health impacts and the impacts on species like the monarch.
Carolyn, how does the federal government come to its conclusions as to the efficacy of these pesticides or herbicides or what have you? Does the federal government conduct tests?
No, for the most part, not. What the government does is request that the pesticide manufacturer either conduct the tests or contract with a laboratory company to do the tests. Not to be overly blunt, but if you were a pesticide company and you were asked to provide health and safety data about your chemical, what incentive would you have to provide data showing that there's a problem? It's a built-in conflict of interest.
And so when we look at what the federal government is telling us, in essence, we are kind of looking at what the industry wants to tell us. Is that a fair summation, Rebecca? Or am I off the base there?
Well, the federal government does look at the studies that are out there. So, and it's true that many of those come from the industry. But what we're hoping is that this time they'll take a more balanced approach and look at all the evidence out there, look at what the World Health Organization looked at, which included epidemiological studies, animal models, and studies of what the mechanism could be for glyphosate to cause cancer, and really take a close look at that data and make an important judgment on what the risk is to human health and the environment.
Mm-hmm. What is the relationship between the federal government and the industry, Carolyn?
I think that's a complicated question. Let me
give you the reason why I ask. I look at the federal government and I see a man named Michael Taylor sitting as the food safety czar of the United States of America, responsible for maintaining the health of our food chain. And Michael Taylor was a former vice president of the Monsanto Corporation. And so that seems like a pretty cozy kind of relationship where you have somebody who's that intimately connected with both sides of the issue running the show.
And, you know, there are hundreds of examples of what is commonly called the revolving door, where people move from the government to one of the companies that they were regulating in their previous job and back and forth like that. It's definitely a problem. I think from the perspective of nonprofit organizations, we can never have as many people at the meetings, as many people visiting government agencies, as the companies, you know, whose profits depend on those relationships with government. So we're always going to be, you know, a few steps behind, despite, you know, trying our best.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're going to take a quick break here, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you about the other side of the coin then, which is to say, why should we believe the nonprofit world, which is the World Health Organization, and its investigative arm, which says that glyphosate is a probable cause of cancer. An entirely different perspective. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. Hey, we might even go to the phones when we get back, pick up Karen, too, who has a question about why even bother getting rid of weeds. Food Chain Radio Program, we have Carolyn Cox, Research Director, Center for Environmental Health, Rebecca Riley, Senior Attorney, Natural Resources Defense Council, and you. 800-624-2665. 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone. Please tell me which we should listen to, the federal government or the World Health Organization. Right back. Well, we have some callers checking in. Before we get to them, I want to ask Carolyn Cox and Rebecca Riley why we should believe the folks at the World Health Organization, who butters their toast, as it were?
The International Agency for Research on Cancer, the World Health Organization branch that, you know, recently did the evaluation of glyphosate's carcinogenicity, is probably the premier organization in the world for doing cancer evaluations. And their charge is, you know, just to look at the science. What does the science tell us? And this is, I think, really different from, say, what EPA does when they do an evaluation, when they are required by law to look at not only the science, but the economic benefits of using the particular
product. So, with respect to the World Health Organization, do they actually do the science, or do they rely on industry studies to do the science for them, and they just interpret it?
Yeah, they just review the science, and it is interesting that they did, you know, look at exactly the same. It wasn't new studies. They looked at the same studies that, you know, EPA had looked at in the past, and but their scientific evaluation was different.
Huh. So here we have the same studies produced by the same industry that essentially manufactures the products, and the government sees it as safe and allows for the doubling of the amount that can be found in food. And the other side said, wait a minute, what we see in these studies is the fact that this is causing cancer in human beings. And so we're stuck trying to figure out who the heck we should believe it, right? Is that pretty much the case?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the really important question to ask is a product like this necessary? Are there alternatives? And actually, there are alternatives. And, you know, we're really fortunate to have a thriving organic food industry in this country. And we can purchase food that was grown without glyphosate or similar chemicals. So,
well, you know, in that light, we have a call from Karen, who has a question that I guess goes right to the heart of what you're saying. Karen, welcome to the Food Chain. Are you there?
Hi. Yes,
go ahead.
I'm here. I'm curious. Why do we need to kill the weeds to begin with? There's a whole industry out there based on killing weeds, and yet we know weeds put nutrients back in the soil, and you can create all kinds of economical ways in which to put them back into the soil. So to me, it's a moot point. You know, why do we need all these chemicals when if we do it naturally?
Well, you know,
everybody wins.
Yeah, but I suspect if you were farming a crop and you had all of your money in that crop, and the crop was in the ground, and you saw weeds growing, and the weeds are stealing the nutrition, they're stealing the moisture out of the ground, they're stealing the sunlight, and you would look at those weeds in a little bit different manner, probably.
I could see that, except I know there's a lot of research coming out of the Oregon State University who actually did studies on, as the weeds come up, you just have equipment that just turns them over again, and it actually gives nutrients to the other plants, too.
Yep. That takes us back to the days when I was a teenage herbicide doing the turning, right?
Right, you were the machine.
I was the machine, yeah. Thank you so much for that call, Karen. Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, let's go to Mark. Mark, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You know, I'm in local agriculture, and we don't have enough water for our crops here locally, let alone to water the weeds. But, you know, the concept of going back to hand weeding, you know, that's a non-go. It hasn't been done in the Midwest for years. And you look at a post-emerge herbicide like glyphosate, and what it replaced was the atrazine, timazine, the Diron, Direx, the pre-emerged herbicides, and they had some environmental.
When you say pre-emergent herbicides, what do you mean by that for the folks that
you
don't know?
You put them down at planting with the corn seed, say, or soybean seed, and they would prevent weeds from emerging as the crop emerges. They'd be selective, they'd take the weeds out, and they'd allow the crop to emerge. Well, what they're doing now, post-emerge, like Roundup, glyphosate, they let the crop emerge, they let the weeds emerge, and then they'll come in and do the application at that time. Well, both are very small. But again, the old simazine, atrazine, Diron had issues with groundwater contamination. And that's why the Roundup, ready crops was, you know, so much more beneficial environmentally than what used to be done. The other thing, you know, speaking of sustainable agriculture, just under the benefits of no-till, or limited till agriculture in the Midwest. And we do not have the dust bowls that we had way back when, because we're not turning the soil into dust, into powder. We're not getting the loss of topsoil that we used to have. And that has all been made possible, again, through GMO crops and, again, through post-emerge application of herbicides. So there's been a huge environmental benefit, again, back to the you know, reduction of groundwater contamination, and also the no-till, limited-till agriculture that prevents topsoil erosion.
Well, Mark, we're going to take a quick break. Can you hang with us for just a second? Because I want to ask you the question, which should we believe? Should we believe the federal government that says glyphosate is safe? Or should we believe the World Health Organization, which says glyphosate causes cancer in human beings? Folks, this is the Food Chain. We have a few minutes left. So much to talk about with Carolyn Cox of the Center for Environmental Health, with Rebecca Riley, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Mark, who is in agriculture here in California. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, folks, we are now using somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 tons of the weed killer glyphosate to get rid of the weeds of the world so we can grow our crops. That's the numbers. The federal government says that glyphosate is safe. It does no harm in the environment, and as a matter of fact, is double the amount allowed in food crops. Whereas the World Health Organization says not so fast. It's a probable cause of cancer in human beings. Both of these organizations looked at the same study and came up with exactly opposite conclusions. Mark, as a professional in agriculture, who should we believe?
Well, the key word there is the world, and the World Health Organization is made up of countries other than the United States, and they would probably like to put U.S. agriculture at a non-competitive disadvantage, so anything they can do to limit, productive agriculture, competitive agriculture in the U.S., they'd probably, you know, latch onto that. You gotta remember, the World Health Organization also gave us Codex Alimentarius over in Europe that we try to comply with them as food exports, and also causes the people in Europe to have to get a prescription to get a vitamin pill. So it's a double-edged sword. But again, you know, the key word there, world, and remember, you know, they're not always, the world's not always looking out for us here.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for being here to express that side of the coin. It always seems to come down to follow the money, and that's what we're doing today, following the money. Carolyn, what do you think as a representative of your organization, the Center for Environmental Health? Who should we listen to? Are you there?
Yeah. This is the way I like to look at it. There are some really well-done long-term studies that show that you can grow corn without using herbicides, using a no-till system that's more drought-resistant and sequesters more carbon than the common systems that use herbicides. So given that, I think we err on the side of caution and move away from these chemicals with health concerns.
Mm-hmm. You're suggesting that we listen to the World Health Organization and not the federal government.
I mean, I'm hoping that the federal government will come in line.
Come to its senses?
Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca, what do you think? Who do we listen to here?
Well, from my perspective, you know, I'm really focused on the impacts on the monarch butterfly, and those impacts are really clear. We know there's been this huge decline, this 90% drop, and we know that glyphosate is a problem. So we want EPA to look at that. They've never looked at this issue before, and we hope that in July, when they come out with their preliminary assessment, that they've grappled with this problem and have looked at ways to solve it. How can we cut back our use? What can farmers do to try to make sure that milkweed can grow so that the monarch butterfly population can rebound?
Is there any other species that's having the trouble that the monarch butterfly is having?
Well, there are plenty of species that are having trouble due to pesticides. The most commonly referenced one is the bees. And we all know bees have suffered huge declines. And scientists believe that's due to a class of pesticides called the neonicotinoids.
There it is. So we're out of time, but I want to thank both you for joining us today, Carolyn Cox and Rebecca Riley. Thank you both so much for joining us. No thank you to Monsanto for not joining us. Heck with you guys. Hope you show up someday to talk about. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.